am I audible?
Yes, Chief.
Am I audible?
You are.
Oh, okay. Good morning, honorable members, the committee staff, Makua Amoa present today. Before I go any further, can I take any apologies?
Good morning, honorable members and our guests. Chair, we've got an apology from the members. Mr. Langa is attending to organizational
recording work, in progress.
And Mr. Zungula is traveling with another committee. And then you receive an apology from the deputy minister who's traveling to Australia and also the DG who's in Indonesia. Thank you, Chair. Those are the only apologies received.
Okay, thank you, this was so much. The next apology is for me, but unfortunately, I'm also on the list. But if I happen to cut off in terms of the connection, I will request that the Honorable Masalem can take over for that period. You don't have to wait for me. But for now, I'm a bit stable. Like I said, that would be the apology I have. Can I then give Ari or Ayanda to project our project for today? We have a meeting today with Makua Amoa. We will first get a report on their social audits, and then we'll deal with questions of clarity and comments. And then after that, we will go for the just a synopsis. With regards to the issue of the High Court ruling, with regards to the mining charter. Secondly, they will then have a fight also to share just a few comments on the issue of illegal mining. And then we will deal with the questions of clarity, comments, and what then becomes.
Ms. Boss, is this where the chair is gone?
I think so, Mr. Mahlaule, because I think he's just given now to Makua to start the presentation. But I'm going to call him and double check.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sorry, Mr. Mahlaula, you can continue. The chair is struggling with the network. It's trying to come in again.
Okay. Thank you very much, colleagues. Good morning. As I have noticed in the agenda, I think we are now going to allow Makua to give us a presentation. I'm correct, Ms. Bosner. That was the next item.
That is
yes,
correct.
Okay. I don't know who is presenting for, on behalf of Makua Wamua, but the floor is yours.
Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing us the opportunity to engage you today. My name is Christopher Rutledge. I am the Executive Director of the Makua Wamua Advice Office. We operate on the mandate of Makua. Makua is a movement of mining-affected communities, and also Wamua, which is Women Affected by Mining United in Action, which is a structure within Makua that organizes around women's issues, particularly as they relate to mining. So thank you very much. The Advice Office has been mandated to assist with the presentation today. And so we'll get straight into it. Thank you very much. So I guess the first question that most of you will ask is, why are we here today? And without trying to be prescriptive, and more to remind ourselves of why we are here today, we thought it important just to locate the importance of this portfolio committee, the importance of Parliament, and the importance of this engagement into context. We know that the South African Constitution is premised on the rule of law, and that it has come to embody the fundamental demand for fair and democratic exercise of public power. And that is a critical point for us. So we understand the role of the law to be able to order the behavior of individuals and organizations so that the economic and social policies can be converted into outcomes. So we are saying that laws are not just made because they need to be made. They are made for a specific outcome. And the MPRDA sits very nicely into that, because the MPRDA, in the way it was structured initially, recognized from its very outset that there was a historical and contemporary injustice that needed to be dealt with, and that mining, as the sector which has basically underpinned the colonial and apartheid project and developed it into an industrial, shall we say, powerhouse at some point on the continent. That was a critical realization. So coming off apartheid, we realized that mining had an important role to play in how we order the behavior of mining companies and individuals who act within the sector. The law also seeks to define the structure of government by ordering how power is distributed. Currently, and we'll show in the next slide, the question of who gets to access and exercise power in the sector is, in our opinion, part of the problem, but we'll come to that in a little while. The role of the law is also to order contestation. So in other words, competing interests in the sector needs to have substantive and procedural tools that one promotes accountability, is able to resolve disputes between the different actors peacefully, and from time to time to change the rules in order to make sure that actors who are not whose interests are not being considered or taken into account, so that their interests can be accommodated. And again, that's part of the reason why we are here today. But we can all agree that the mere existence of laws by no means leads to their intended outcome and effects. And we hope to show you today that despite the fact that the MPRDA of 2002 is an advancement on the colonial apartheid project, there's no doubt about that. Despite that, the intended outcomes of ensuring a more equitable distribution, ensuring that those who are directly impacted by mining operations are accounted for and their interests are taken into account, those things we will show to you today is not emerging after almost 20 years of this piece of legislation. So essentially, we are saying that in the same way that apartheid and the colonial project used the law to perpetuate social and power relations, the underdevelopment of particularly Black communities, and which drives, the inequality that South Africa is so well renowned for today. The law often is the basis on which those processes emerge. And part of what we are going to propose to you today is that the current legislation contributes unintentionally to the deepening of inequality, the deepening of underdevelopment, and the stagnation and insecurity that is experienced by mining-affected communities. So we know that the law can be something that holds us back, or it can be something that takes us forward. It can shape the way that we engage with each other. And for us, that is critical. The law can change the incentives. And we're saying that the MPRDA, as it currently stands, and the incentives that it provides is wholly skewed. We can establish different payoffs. What are the things that mining companies will do so that they can derive a benefit for the shareholders? At the moment, though, the way that the law is structured contributes, like I said earlier, to ensuring that the developmental objectives of the MPRDA are not being met, despite what the Minerals Council has been saying. And we'll try and show that to you today. In a nutshell, we are essentially here because the lived experiences of mining-affected communities tells us that the law is not working for them. If we use, for example, the United Nations characteristics of good governance as a starting point, then we would see, for example, that on all of the 8 characteristics that the United Nations suggests are important for good governance, we see that there are 2, one can call it 3 if one includes government. The 3 key parties to the MPRDA, which is business and labor and government, but for now let's assume that government is a separate, we'll look at the key, the stakeholders of business and labor. We'll see that in terms of participation, they would more than likely agree that their levels of participation are, if not acceptable, it's certainly better than those experienced by communities. For example, directly after the Mining Court judgment in September of last year, the Minerals Council met with the minister, met with the DMRE. Not long after that, they met with Parliament. Whereas communities, We've been knocking at the door, engaging in protest, writing petitions. We've been dancing and basically creating a spectacle in order to get participation. So from a community point of view, participation certainly doesn't rank. I know that some of us will argue today that there are regulations that deal with participation. But hopefully, as we go through our social audit report, you will see that these are about perspectives. That, again, it might be there in the law, but in terms of its meaningfulness, in terms of how it is perceived by people, and in terms of how it is experienced, there is no participation from a community perspective. In terms of the rule of law, again, we will try and show to you today that mining companies and labor have access to the rule of law. In terms of labor, there's a whole labor law and other health and safety acts and a range of other acts which governs how labor is treated and how the interests are accounted for. So in terms of that, labor can rely on the rule of law in order to ensure that its interests are dealt with. For business, I mean, there's no question about it. Just now, Makua is being once again threatened by a mining company that they will sue us for defamation or take us to court because our activist in Kraalhoek, a deep rural community on the border, right at the top of the border of South Africa with Botswana, because that community has been complaining that the mine, and we've shown it in the social audit reports as well, that the mine has not delivered on its social and labor plans. Now, instead of dealing with the community, they're threatening to interdict us, to take us to court for defamation with slap suits. So for mining companies, the rule of law, and as we know, they went to court on the mining court judgment as well. So for mining companies, the rule of law is a given. They thrive on the rule of law. But for communities, when we report non-compliance of social labor plans, and we'll show it to you today, we get no response. We get nothing. We cannot go to court because communities don't have the funds and the resources. You know, even though they are legal clinics, that is no solution because we cannot rely on the court every time when we have an issue to have to try and find hundreds of thousands and millions of rands to enrich lawyers to get the access to the rule of law. So communities are not there. I'm going to try and speed up a bit. In terms of transparency, we struggle to get information out of mining companies. We'll show that to you today. In fact, the DMRE, despite its regulations which have agreed that social and labor plans are public documents and should be open and transparent and we should be able to access it, they've instituted more stringent regulations when we do PIA applications. So now, when we do a PIA application, there's a whole process of proving a mandate and a range of stuff, more hurdles that they put in the way of mining communities trying to get access to information. So mining communities, there's no transparency for us. There's nothing that emerges. In terms of responsiveness, we've got a 0% response rate from the DMRE on the complaints of non-compliance that we've lodged with them. And it's not the same again for business and labor. You know, they have direct lines into the minister. They have direct lines into all kinds of areas of power. Communities do not. In terms of the MPRDA being consensus orientated, we can agree that business and labor were key parties to the development of the legislation. And so to a large extent, they were part of that consensus which generated the MPRDA. Communities were not. There was no interested and affected parties which spoke to the interest of communities. And that is reflected in the legislation because, you know, the communities where we organize, they have a saying. If we are not on the table, at the table, making decisions, then we are definitely on the menu. So this is the truth of the reality, is that when an interested and affected party is not there to raise and engage the power holders and duty bearers around the issues, then those issues are not going to be addressed. And it's clearly not addressed in the MPRDA. In terms of equity and inclusiveness, again, we will show that there's no inclusiveness in the process, despite the Minerals Council coming to you and presenting you a report which says that they've got 89% compliance in terms of community participation. That's nonsense. We will show that it barely exists, that communities are not being consulted. Where they demand consultation, they're being threatened with lawsuits and interdicts. In terms of equity, there's no equity, because we will also show in our baseline report, we've shown, and across a range of other reports, we've shown that communities are becoming poorer. Money is being circulated at higher elite levels, and communities, and the social audit report will show you that, are not receiving the benefits. By the Minerals Council's own admission, the vast majority of their community development stuff goes to big infrastructure projects which benefit them, and the rest goes to anomalous donations that they don't report on and they don't feel the need to report on. So there's no equity. In terms of effectiveness and efficiency, that also is not emerging, because, again, we'll show there's non-delivery. In terms of accountability, nobody is accountable to affected communities. It doesn't seem as if they have a voice. Mining companies don't feel they need to listen to communities. They don't need to engage with communities. And so, you know, there's just no accountability from a mining affected community perspective. Now, please keep in mind that these are our perspectives. We are trying to show to you the experiences of mining affected communities. Certainly, as a politician in parliament, you have a view of the law and a view of how the world is unfolding. But we must remember that the people who experience these injustices are the ones we should listen to. And this is what we're trying to propose to you today. So then as I wrap up the introduction to this part, we did a baseline survey research in 2018. And we see that through the way that the law is experienced, that legality, this question of legality that we will deal with later on when it comes to Zamazamas, is generally biased towards powerful actors. So those who are organized in the form of labor and in business, their power is enhanced by the way that the MPRDA is structured, whereas community power is diminished, and often their legality, their standing is diminished. You know, our research and what we'll show you today points to the unlawful behavior of these powerful actors. Mining companies are routinely not upholding their end of the bargain. They are not complying with their mining licenses. The little that there is in the law which holds them to account, they are not complying. And their unlawful behavior is being rewarded by continued support for their licenses, and not their licenses are not being withdrawn. They're not being fined or held to account. And these things, this dereliction of duty, this dereliction of the developmental imperatives, is deepening inequality in the sector. I don't have to tell this committee that the deepening of inequality has only one outcome, and it's not social cohesion. And certainly, as we will show to you, you know, the need for us to engage and deal with this question is growing by the day. In the same way that we spoke to the DMRE back in 2016 about dealing with the Zama-Zama question, they failed to deal with it, and today it has become a crisis. And so in the same way, we're saying that the MPRDA needs to be reconsidered unless it is to lead to a crisis. We cannot continue to criminalize young black men and black people in general for simply demanding their right to put food on the table, or their right to have fair compensation and redress for the impacts of mining on their life. So, in short, that was the introduction. What we'll do now is I'll hand over to Fillion Hwache, who is our head of our legal unit, who was instrumental in working with communities to develop the social audit report of 2022. And she will take you through that. Fillion?
Thank you, Chris. So basically, our focus was on, you know, the laws governing mineral extraction, which is the MPRDA, which require that mining companies submit a social and labor plan as part of their application for a mineral right. Right. So effectively, the social and labor plan gives the mining company a social license to operate, but more than that, it becomes a condition of the mining right, as well as, you know, fulfillment of that social and labor plan. And just to explain a little bit what a social labor plan is, it's a document compiled by a mining company, which is supposed to be developed through a public participation process, wherein interested and affected parties contribute to the formulation of the document and have a say in what kinds of projects they'd like to be implemented. Right. So the idea is that community development initiatives should empower communities such that they are able to challenge the conditions and structures that lead to their disempowerment by increasing skills, knowledge, and effectively enhancing elements of social inclusion. And development initiatives should be sustainable at the very least. However, that's not taking place if there are disproportionate power relations in the manner that Christopher just described, wherein community participation does not inform the goals and strategies linked to that development. You know, the rhetoric is always that mining activities will provide development in the form of employment, opportunities for education, and, you know, just social initiatives for mining communities. However, we in mining affected communities aren't necessarily seeing the successful implementation of any of those initiatives. Now, many communities impacted by mining are severely underdeveloped, even though the mining companies at their doorsteps have been continuously profiting from the extraction of the minerals and operating for hundreds of years. Makua and Wamua, we conducted a series of 10 social audits in various communities to assess the social impact that those mining companies have in those communities. And the social audits were community-led by members in branches of Makua. And they involved a process of training the community on what the social audit process is, looking into detail into the social and labor plans of the selected mining companies, and then, you know, formulating a questionnaire that would allow the community members to assess whether, you know, the developmental projects committed to by mining companies are actually benefiting the community, whether they've been implemented, and to really just gauge what's going on in terms of, you know, the implementation of the project committed to by mining companies. What we noticed are really three core themes here, that mining companies are unwilling to consult with mining affected communities as key stakeholders and update them on the process of projects that are due to be implemented in their communities. You know, just the general lack of a developmental approach, that there's widespread non-compliance by mining corporations with legally binding obligations to implement local economic development projects, as well as other human resource development projects in host communities, and that there's a lack of political will by both the Portfolio Committee on Mineral Resources and Energy, as well as the regulatory oversight and compliance monitoring department of the DMRE. So that's also kind of framed this thing where if we're talking about development, we can't exclude the voices of communities in that development. None of the mining companies audited undertook a process of public participation in the formulation of their social and labor plans. And that just speaks to the fact that even when we were conducting the training on social and labor plans, etc., none of the community members actually knew such a document existed. None of them knew that they were able to access this document. You know, the kinds of projects that should be undertaken by mining companies should be determined by those affected by their operations. So it's strange that community voices are constantly lacking when it comes to issues that directly impact them. It's imperative for communities to be intimately involved in the decision-making structures that determine and affect their everyday existence. Without community participation in deciding on the issues that directly affect them, communities won't be able to meaningfully engage and develop their communities, much less benefit from the extractive operations as the MPRDA mandates. Across the board, 92% of the respondents didn't know what a social and labor plan is, despite the clear regulations that they should be consulted during the development of the social and labor plan and that the social and labor plan should be published by the mining companies and, you know, announcements should be made as to where communities can find the social and labor plans. Secondly, in order to drive sustainable development in disadvantaged communities, you know, these social and labor plans actually need to be implemented. 70% of the affected communities that had a keen interest in like human resource development programs such as learnerships, bursaries, and ABET weren't able to access these projects at large because of poor advertising by the mining companies and, you know, exclusive selection processes whereby there are representative structures that don't necessarily represent the community as a whole. And that's why it would be important for them to publicly advertise and make sure that there's an equal opportunity for all members in the community to participate in the available opportunities, should they be available. Only about 4.3% of the local economic projects audited were actually seen to completion by mining companies at the time of the social audits. And this was, the social audits were conducted on SLPs that were already past their five-year term, right? About 69.6% of the local economic projects audited were not completed. They did not exist. They weren't even started at all by the mining companies. And only 26.1% were partially completed by mining companies to varying degrees. And I think this will become clearer as we continue with going through the different mining companies that we audited. One of the mines that forms part of the 10 case studies is Ivanplats, which is a mining company, Ivanhoe Mines, and we audited their 2014 to 2018 social and labor plan and the commitments that were there. Right. So four of some of the projects that we audited was sanitation for schools, the multipurpose centers, the school support and development program, the SMME development and poverty alleviation project, the Lesedi childhood, early childhood development and business center. What we found is that even though there was a commitment for Ivanplats to build multi-purpose hubs across the community, the project was completely abandoned. There are no multi-purpose hubs that were actually built by Ivan Plus during the 2014 to 2018 period. And then with regards to the school support and development program, Ivan Plus had identified 8 schools, which they would sponsor with teachers developing infrastructure needed by the school and upgrading equipment, right? The budget allocated for the project was 14.4 million rand. So we went to 4 of the schools, one which was a daycare center, Lekhaya Labana, and that 1.5 million was committed to infrastructure upgrades. However, physical inspection of the school shows the small two-room dwelling with a garage and a small patch of garden that had not been in use since 2020. Now, that information was gathered throughout the survey process as well as the physical inspection of the actual building. And according to their annual compliance reports, the company notes that they've put in a food garden and a play area and made other upgrades to the infrastructure itself. However, in this picture that you can see on your screens now, there is no play area. There's just a small patch of garden somewhere there, and we can't really say where expenditure fell in terms of you know, these upgrades that were worth 1.5 million. Ivan Plus also reported in their annual compliance reports that they installed smart boards at 2 high schools, which we audited, and that they also built administration blocks for the schools. In fact, there were no administration blocks contributed by Ivan Plus at the schools that we audited, and there were no smart boards. What could be seen in those schools is a science lab and a computer lab. Now, these were corrugated iron science labs and computer labs, can fit approximately 20 students. And the budget allocated to each of these schools was 1.5 million. However, at one of the schools that we were at, there was a pre-existing computer lab which could have been upgraded, and that computer lab could accommodate 40 students. However, the mine chose not to. And, you know, because there's no transparency around their annual compliance reports, as and when they're reporting on these projects, they're not holding consultative meetings with community members in Mokopane. There's no way to actually track the development of this process and whether the science lab and the computer lab are actually beneficial in the schools themselves. Furthermore, according to staff at the schools, there were no extra classes provided for students funded by Ivan Plus. There was no teachers that were teaching on behalf of Ivan Plus. However, what was done was that Ivan Plus organized a competition of sorts for gifted science and math students, which was national but did not specifically target the schools quoted in their SLP, which then brings into question, you know, what did Ivan Plus specifically contribute in terms of their social and labor plans? And the committed values to the project is also seriously brought into question by the social audit conducted. Because if development equates to ticking boxes, it can perhaps be said that Ivan Plus attempted and made a really good attempt at fulfilling some of its commitments. However, an argument can be made that they have not sufficiently lived up to the commitments in their social and labor plan and have not effectively implemented those. Thirdly, there was supposed to be the Lesedi Early Childhood Development Center and a business hub, right? That project was allocated a budget of 12 million rand. However, when we went to verify the project, only small upgrades to the roof were actually contributed by Ivan Platz. They did form a food garden, and they also created they provided for a borehole and water management system. However, the food garden did not survive due to COVID-19 because people weren't able to continue taking care of the garden because of a lack of resources to, you know, sustainably push the project forward, as Ivan Platz's contributions ended in 2018. And there was no strategy around how to make sure that the food garden, etc., is sustainable beyond that. More than that, there was no business center at the Lesedi Childhood Development and Business Center project site. No one knew about the business center, and therefore it's not actually contributing anything meaningful to the community in Mokopane. Now, another mine that we audited is Harmony Gold, operating in Carltonville. It's the Usasalethu mining operation. And it was found that the mine committed to a digital hub and providing computer training programs for out-of-school youth and computer literacy training. They committed to a waste recycling project, SMME development, farm support, education infrastructure, health infrastructure, and developing community rental units as well. Four out of the seven projects were audited and physically inspected by the social audit team conducting the social audit. With regards to the digital hub, which you can see on your screens, which was already a backlog project when it was put in the 2013 to 2017 SLP. However, the mine, although it committed to supporting computer training programs and computer literacy training, the project itself was completed in 2014. However, by 2015, the project was completely abandoned, even though the signage for the project remained until 2020. And this speaks again to the sustainability of the project, because if we're saying that projects in the SLPs can be implemented for a day and then disappear, then we're not talking about mining companies contributing to the development in mining affected communities. We're talking about a piecemeal approach to development, which is insufficient and not in line with the required legislative kind of mechanisms, right? The mine also committed to develop the vacant Beelkraal hostel complex into a community rental project, where there'd be the required amenities to sustain a vibrant community. So that meant that they would put 556 1-to-3 bedroom flats, including a private primary school in the location there, and other things as well. The budget was said to be 180 million. And in phase one, they had completed 8 show flats, the value of which was 2.8 million rand. However, community members around the area did not know about these show flats. And when we went to go see the Geelkraal community rental units, no, there was no development at all. The building was vacant, dilapidated, and there was no sign that Harmony Gold had actually made any kind of efforts with regards to fulfilling this SLP project. And I mean, the projects that we're talking about here, the digital hub, as well as the Geelkraal community rental units, those would have been great projects if implemented and supplemented and actually functional, because education and skill development could have been, you know, something tangible, especially with regards to computer literacy and the manner that we're moving as we go forward in the technological age, right? and the housing project in a town which is deeply affected by being like a dolomitic area because of the sinkholes there. The housing project could have really been something that would have benefited the community greatly, just because people would be able to move out of areas where there's sinkholes immediately next to them, and then, you know, relocate themselves to the community rental project. Another SLP that we audited was in Palavora, the 2013 to 2018 SLP of Foursquare. We audited four of the five projects because one was upgrading and refurbishing the electricity network, which would have been difficult to necessarily audit. The landfill site, the rehabilitation of streets, the upgrading of Wolanoto, and building the construction of a school. Now, it's initially in their 2013 to 2018 SLP, the rehabilitation of streets was actually quoted at 18 million rand, whereas the school project did not exist. However, the mine, along with the DMRE, unilaterally decided that they are going to include a school project without consulting community members, and the rehabilitation of streets project was put down to 13 million rand and allocated the 5 million rand to the construction of the school. In terms of the waste management and recycling depot, which would have been the landfill site, there was no landfill site. There was only a partially fenced portion of land. And when we went to go check with the municipal manager tried to assert that one of the reasons that there was no landfill site was due to COVID and because no work could be done during 2020. However, the SLP should have been fulfilled by 2018. And this is particularly important because a common trend amongst all the communities audited is that the LED departments, department managers and municipalities are often not aware of projects being implemented by the mining companies, even though they are the local economic development department. And that speaks to, you know, the exclusion of local stakeholders in kind of the mine's relations and you know, implementation of these SLPs as well as formulation. Now, Foursquare committed to refurbishing 10 roads in the CBD in Palavora, by resealing the tar, painting road marks, patching potholes, etc. And all 10 roads that were meant to be fixed had still not been fixed in 2022. In fact, the Department of Public Works confirmed having no knowledge of any roadwork projects that were carried out between 2013 and 2017 along with Foursquare. And the budget allocated to that was 13 million rand after the unilateral revision, right? In terms of the construction of the school remains unfinished now in 2022. And there's a board there that says the project should have been finalized in 12 months. However, there's still no toilets. And the Department of Education has no knowledge of the school that's being constructed by Foursquare. However, I want to reiterate that all of these projects should have been completed by 2018. Then we go on to speak about Aganang Sipaku in Springbokbaan. And another common trend is, you know, the non-fulfillment of any of the social and labor plan commitments, because they committed to the brick making and distribution facility, a safe hub, a youth development center, and an agri-park project whereby there'd be sunflower seed production project as well as a food bank project. And all of these projects were supposed to be at the same site. However, not a single one was present when we went to do the physical verification. None of the community members even knew that Akhanang Sephaku was supposed to implement any of these projects. And, you know, it's very jarring when we are confronted with the rampant non-compliance by all of these companies, which continue to operate, despite the fact that they've clearly not compliant with a condition of their mining rights. In Kraluk, Kalaka Mining, which is now Afrimat because recently there was a transfer of the mining right to Afrimat, committed to one large water project, which was not allocated a budget at all in the SLP. However, you know, they were supposed to erect two large JoJo tanks in one area, do some maintenance on some pipelines, and make sure that there's a trough so that animals could have some drinking water. They committed to another to reviving another borehole, whereby they put one 10,000 liter JoJo tank with a pump because it's quite low, and you know, investigate a new pipeline from borehole one to borehole three. And then in another phase, they would have investigated further water supply, where there's a borehole by a school, and they'd supplement that with two 2,000 liter JoJo tanks and figure out the piping there as well. When we went to the site of all of these projects, because they had GPS coordinates, there were no JoJo tanks at all. There was no work that was done by the mining company in terms of any pipelines or investigating any pipelines. In fact, during a meeting held with the mine, they confirmed that they did not implement any of the projects cited in their social and labor plan. And you know, this is important because the residents of Kraluk during the social audit expressed overwhelming dissatisfaction with the quality of water, complaining that, you know, it has a lot of lime in it, it makes them sick, it has a bad taste. But the one project that would have actually attempted to supplement, you know, access to water in that community was completely ignored by the mining company. And although with all of these mines that we audited, we've reported the non-compliance to the Department of Mineral Resources, or asked the Department of Mineral Resources to come do an on-site inspection, in particularly Kalaka, Kraluk, there's been non-response or piecemeal responses, in the sense that when the community wrote to the DMRE late last year and asked them to do an on-site inspection, not all the stakeholders were present. And so the DMRE committed to come back early this year, which they failed to do, despite numerous kind of engagements from our side to say, please, can you come back to the community and actually do this inspection, because there's issues related to the fencing off of the mining operation, as there are holes being dug right next to people's backyards. There's issues related to, you know, leftover pits which are unfenced and cause a health and safety hazard to community members, especially kids during rainy seasons, and animals and livestock, you know. And so what we see as a theme during all of these social audits that are conducted is that there's environmental issues such as air, land, and water pollution, right? Threats that can impact, you know, the well-being of humans as well as livestock. People in mining affected communities are generally living in an unsafe environment, which relates to kind of blasting as well as rising crime levels in the communities. There's a constant threat to health which just emanates from, you know, silicosis, lung problems, and emanates from the operations of the mining companies. So although there's a wide array of non-compliance that's been identified and verified throughout the social audits, there's no avenue for the mining affected community members to actually voice their concerns, because the DMRE and its regional managers are highly unresponsive. And even though non-compliance is reported and it is a condition of the mining rights of the companies, there are no repercussions for the mining companies. And it's like the companies themselves are reliant on the lack of the DMR to actually implement legislation and enforce it and monitor it, that they feel like they don't have to actually live up to the commitments that are in their social and labor plans, etc., to the exclusion and of community members, and just further exacerbating social ills that are prevalent in the mining affected communities. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Philia. So just the last couple of points then for us to wrap this portion up. So, you know, one of the claims that the Minerals Council, for example, made to the Portfolio Committee is that their projects that they are implementing, besides the fact that they claim a 90% success rate, we are showing you that that's closer to zero. They're also saying that the type of projects that they're implementing are what the community has been asking for. And yet at the same time, they show us that the bulk of their money is going to stuff which the communities are not asking for. From our research, the communities seem to be asking for more employment, skills development, and livelihood options. And across all of the audits that we have done, that seems to be at the bottom of the list of priorities in terms of social and labor plans. Sorry. A lot of people said that the mines needed to be more accountable, there needed to be more consultation, and, you know, communication, transparency, openness from the mine to say, this is what we're doing, these are how we are allocating contracts, these are the things that have been done. But basically, people are living in ignorance, and the mine continues to just do as it pleases, and like I say, no accountability. And then obviously there are still needs for extensive services like water and roads and stuff like that. And also the question of compensation. Communities have noted the fact that even though mines impact on their health, on their heritage, on their culture, on their livelihoods, you know, there's no compensation, there's no appreciation for the fact that communities are directly impacted in this way. So when we look at the overall picture of the MPRDA and how the mining sector pans out, we see that, you know, government takes a according to PricewaterhouseCoopers, right, they do a annual report on the mining sector across the world, but in South Africa they also do one. And if we look, and they take the top 80% of the JSE listed mining companies, and they look at how that company stack up. So if we look at their figures, then government takes approximately 24% of value created. Employees, which includes management, takes up to 47%, and then shareholders take a whopping 29% of value reported. While community investments, according to our calculations on value reported in the PricewaterhouseCoopers reports, 0.9% of that value that mining companies report on the financials is allocated to community development projects. The Minerals Council, in its report to you in November, actually said that in terms of its sales, only 0.15% of sales is allocated.
Mr. Routledge?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Routledge, just a minute. Is Chair Luzipo in the platform?
Yes, I'm here, Honorable Mahlaule, but still on the road. Let's continue, don't worry.
No, no, if I was to continue, Chair, I would say the program says that Makua will have the first presentation until 10-2. We're at 10 o'clock now. How far are you, Makua, to finish with the presentation?
We have two slides to go, really.
Okay, let's proceed in 5 minutes. Let's okay. Wrap up.
Can I request that because their main submission was on the social body, if Chris, you are chowing that time, it means it will impact on the next two other items. But I know that your main submission was on the social body.
Yes.
I think that you must try and accommodate yourselves on the next two items, because as you know that in our discussion, 12:30 by the committee
is
part of time. Okay.
Agreed, Chair. Thank you very much.
But you can continue, Honorable Marshall, because I will make noise.
Thank you very much. Right. So essentially, after all what we've presented, we are calling on the portfolio committee specifically to facilitate the inclusion of Makua and Wamua and mining affected communities more broadly and civil society partners, so that the voices of affected communities can be on multi-stakeholder policy engagement structures, such as MIGDET or other structures that may emerge. One of the proposals we want to make to the committee is around the Transformation Committee, which ironically is in support of the Minerals Council's proposal to you as well. But we'll get to that later. We are calling on the committee to ensure that the law is structured so that communities have an opportunity to provide input throughout the policymaking and lawmaking process. Because when it comes to a written comment stage, that's a bit too late, because already the decisions have been taken and people have agreed amongst themselves what it is that they want to achieve, which excludes communities. And the core part of what we're saying is community voice must be there so that there is a fairer and more equitable and just outcome that is derived from the law. We're calling on enhancements to the manner in which broad public participation processes are conducted, but we can get into the detail of that later. The commencement of a process aimed at amending the MPRDA is critical so that we begin to deal with this crisis before it becomes a storm, before it becomes something that we are going to struggle to get out of. We still have the opportunity now to correct the law to make sure that its outcomes are more equitable and just. The jurisprudence around community rights has been evolving as well. And one can look at the Maledu and Baleni judgments, amongst others. And so the law, being 20 years old as it is, needs to, in any case, adjust, given that we are going to have the discussion around the mining charter later. The need to adjust the law is emerging very clearly. And then obviously one of the things that fell out of the mining charter issue, and we'll deal with later, is the targets for women. And then we're asking on the portfolio committee to demand accountability from the Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy for the lack of oversight that the DMRE is exercising over the transformation agenda in the sector. We feel that there needs to be more accountability. Why is it that a social audit report like we've just presented is possible? We have to fix that. We demand that the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy also be held to account for its failure to uphold the law. The fact that we've lodged these non-compliance issues and they've just not responded, whether it's through capacity or lack of will, that I guess the committee will have to decide on. In terms of the DMRE itself, we're saying that it is clear that the DMRE is not able to manage the existing areas that it needs to regulate. And we're calling on the DMRE to place a moratorium on issuing mining license and prospecting license until we can adequately account for the failures to hold current mining holders' license to account. What's the use of adding more fuel to the fire when you can't maintain or you can't manage the existing fire? Account for the continued reduction in compliance budgets. So linked to this is, if you look at the budgets that is being approved for the DMRE, they are increasing their sales and advocacy to get mining companies to come to South Africa, but they are reducing their budget for compliance. There are less and less people employed in compliance. And how is that going to work? We are creating a disaster. So they have to account for that. Commit to the principles of Batopele, because again, communities, when they deal with it, with the DMRE, it's just egregious. They don't get any respect. There's no avenues for them to deal with. It's just a disaster. We're asking the DMRE to commit to investigating the non-compliance that we're bringing to light in this report, that they commit to immediately publishing the annual compliance reports. That's another area. Those annual compliance reports are being held captive by the DMRE. So we don't know what the mining companies are doing. And as you can see, in the absence of the light, in the darkness, they are deceiving South Africa. Mining companies are deceiving South Africa because they're not delivering. We're asking them to commit to urgently revising the SLP regulations to ensure that the SLPs and IDP commitments are clearly delineated and accounted for. So in other words, we need to make sure what is for the broader IDP and what is for directly affected communities. We ask that the DMRE notifies all the regional officers and license holders of the regulations with regard to the right of communities to access information, because that still remains a huge, huge problem. Commit to urgently reviewing regulations which impose burdens on communities when seeking access to information. And we've spoken briefly about that, but because of time, I'm going to end it there. The rest, I'm sure you will read. So in summary, members of the portfolio committee, communities are completely excluded. They're at the mercy of powerful actors. And you as the lawmakers, the people who have the opportunity to right the wrongs, this is the opportunity. All the cards have been dealt and they're laying and they're telling us that the MPRDA needs to be amended. Community interest must be accounted for. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hello, continue, Honorable Mashaule, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm worried about the compliance and the rules of Parliament on this, since you are still on the platform. But if other members are not objecting to that, I'm happy to continue. Can I thank you very much, Makua, for the presentation. You have finished at 9 past, as we had indicated. You'll have to accommodate your time in that regard. Honorable members, there is the presentation. Can I note hands which wants to engage the presentation? Ayanda and Ari, can you also assist me with the hands? I don't see any hands so far. Okay, I think
there's Malinga.
Any other hands? Okay. Maybe we'll get hands when as and when we go. Honorable Malinga.
Thank you very much, Chair. I hope I am audible. I am in the rural Mpumalanga. Am I audible?
Yes, okay. You are audible. Can you proceed? Okay, let me note Honorable Madokwe as well, after Honorable Malinga. Can you proceed?
Greetings to yourself, members of the Portfolio Committee, the Makua delegation, committee staff, and everybody on call. Chairperson, I hope I hear the chair or Ms. Boss giving apologies to, in an effect that the DG is not on the platform. I hope we have somebody who's acting on his behalf on this platform. Chairperson,
the DG is on the platform.
Oh, okay. All right.
DG Mbele is on the platform.
Oh, I heard the apology that is out of the country. My apologies, Chair. Chairperson, I had hoped that Makua will start by apologizing to the Portfolio Committee. Maybe I did not get it because my network is up and down on their behavior when we were doing our public hearings on gas amendment bill. I thought maybe they will apologize and give us the reasons why they disrupted our public hearings. But nonetheless, hopefully, Mr. Christopher or whoever represents Makua will give us their apology when they respond. Chairperson, I welcome the presentation by themselves, and as this, as myself and the organization that I represent, I am for the social labor plans. We are very biased to social labor plans, and we are biased to mining companies ensuring that where they mine, the community benefits. My proposal, Chair, is that can we as the portfolio, we note what they have presented to us. Can we, as the Portfolio Committee, maybe converse among ourselves on the issues that were presented to us than to think on our feet? If Makua can, it's my proposal, Chair. If Makua can give us that opportunity, I'm not sure, Chair, given the packed program that we have as the portfolio, if we can maybe find a day that we can engage among ourselves on the issues that they are here, that are here in front of the Portfolio Committee. That will be my proposal, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Malinga. Honorable Matokwe.
Thank you, Chairperson of the session. I'd also like to welcome the report. And also appreciate the report from Marco, and also greet everyone that's in the meeting. I actually would want to support the proposal by Member Malinga, but over and above that, perhaps what I would request, because I know that in the presentation they also alluded to the fact that there are a number of complaints and a number of reports that they have sent to the department, and those reports were never responded to. If we can perhaps have like a compilation of those reports and complaints, and then also when were they submitted, so that they can be referred to the DMRE, so that in the meeting, I'm hoping that then we can then, in the meeting that where we'll be deliberating on this report some more, then maybe the department would also then be able to account on our side in terms of what has been their response or what has been their action, and where there's been no action, then what becomes the way forward. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Madokwe. Is there any other member who wants to say something on this matter before we give a way forward? Okay, nice. I am inclined to agree to the proposal made by Honorable Malinga, precisely because MACUA now has our attention as the committee, because they followed the proper processes and a decorum to get our attention, unlike in the past, where there was no decorum in the way in which they interacted with us. It made me even wonder whether these mining companies, when they are engaged by MACUA, isn't it the same attitude that they are given, and in return have a bad attitude towards meeting the communities? It makes me wonder, because before this meeting, I was thinking, what is it that we will say to each other with MACUA, because we know them not to have a decorum. And I must say, I'm very impressed that today we are having this conversation from a point of view where there's also research that gives us a way to look at the mining companies and lack of seeing through their commitments. We'll be able to look at the department and say, but there has been engagement that MACUA has initiated with you. Why are you not responding? I'm saying you have leveled the ground for us to be able to move forward. You have our attention, and therefore we will make time and sit among ourselves to look at what you have raised, comparing it with obviously the mining houses themselves on the report that you have produced. And I must say I'm very happy that we are working on something that has got decorum, facts, and well researched, well presented, unlike in the past. So I want to thank the MACUA for this presentation, and I will give them time to respond to what has been raised. But in the main, we are saying that you have our attention, and we will give this presentation necessary attention and engage among ourselves and have a way forward. Can I give Mr. Routledge and your team?
Thank you, Chair. I believe that our national coordinator is in the meeting. Mr. Mangula, I wonder if I can allow you to go first before
I... Hopefully I'm audible. Greetings to everyone, to the PC committee. Thank you for really giving us time to present our research and giving us time to talk to you. We really appreciate it, highly appreciate it. And we believe that is now this platform will definitely assist us in sorting out the problems that we are facing of non-compliance from the mines, and have platform again with the DMR to sort out our problems, and even in the regions as well, because that's what was really troubling our communities. But in all, again, I think on the issue of leadership, who indicated the issue of disturbing the issue of the case, I think it was through frustration of communities of none, again, meaningful consultation to really engage, to understand what is happening. Because believe me, you, we have a lot of issues of communities being forcefully removed, having cracked houses by the mines, a lot of things that are happening. So it was really not to disrespect, but to force a platform where we can engage in a meaningful way. You know, we talk about free, prior, informed consent that should be legislated so that we can be given that leverage to be able to say what is that is frustrating communities. And we have even definitely consulted the MRE and gave them the reports of what are the issues that we are facing. But the answer was that we don't have capacity to monitor all these mines. And I think Comrade Rutledge put it very well to say, how do you continue issuing licenses when you are failing, you don't have capacity to manage or, you know, regulate the mines that are there or not non-compliance, because we have proven to them. But unfortunately, it failed in this year. We've seen communities not being consulted, mining coming in without any understanding, and of people, you know, to raise their concerns around those issues. So we believe that this platform of this kind is open to us. We won't be seeing issues of friction amongst ourselves, but we'll see issues of correcting the wrongs that were being done and making sure communities where they're hosting mines, they benefit correctly so and uplift their lives. And we'll see solving the issue of inequality, because when you go in a mining area, you smell poverty, and it's supposed to have, opposite of that. So based on such, we believe that if there is monitoring of these mines, we'll definitely see a change in our communities, alleviating poverty, inequality, and starvation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rutledge, ordinarily, for us to maintain decorum in Parliament, we respect protocol, meaning between you and the national coordinator, I don't know who becomes senior, but I see a hand of Mr. Paps Litoko. We ordinarily do not recognize any other hand that is not coming from you or whoever is coordinating the team. For an example, if the department was presenting to us, it's the DG who would, I hand over to the DG and the DG would point out who must speak on what issue. I can't recognize any other hand that is not an honorable member or a member of parliament. We are giving Makua through you, Mr. Rutledge. I don't recognize any hands outside that. You will be the one who directs who must speak on what issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Shlaule. Appreciate it. Mr. Paps Litoko is with our delegation. Mr. Paps will be speaking later to the committee around the artisanal mining and the question of legality of informal mining. So if I may, Mr. Chair, with your permission, allow Mr. Paps to just make a brief point.
Yes, thank you very much, Comrade Chris. I just wanted to inquire, because I've heard on your response as Parliament, the issue of what was your response on the issue of illegal mining? Because okay. I think I missed on your response with regards to that.
No, sure. Perhaps we are going to still deal with that section. So if you can just bear with us. So, Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Just briefly then summarize what Ms. Madokwe and Malinga had been referring to. So the question of our engagements with the Portfolio Committee came up, and I think our leader did deal with it very well. Suffice to say, Chair and members, that we have documented a very long history of engaging with both the DMRE and the Portfolio Committee since 2012, since the formation of Makua in 2012, through 2013, when the amendments to the MPRDA was up for discussion, right through all of the different ministers, right up until Minister Mantashe came on board and scrapped the MPRDA process, the mining charter process and all of that good stuff. So we have a long history of engaging with both the Portfolio Committee and the DMRE with very little success. And as Mishak indicated, that this has led to a lot of frustrations on our part, even so much so that just recently after our meeting in March, so you must understand how this comes about. We had a meeting with the Portfolio Committee in March in which certain commitments were made. The minister was going to meet with us and he committed in the Portfolio Committee meeting to meet with us. He set up the meeting at the last minute. He cancelled and he's never come back to us to have that meeting again. We wrote to the Portfolio Committee to say, look, you and I and the minister, we agreed that we would have this meeting to try and iron out these issues. It hasn't happened. We're asking the Portfolio Committee to intervene. And we've just had no responses. We've had no engagements from the Portfolio Committee. And that breeds frustration. So much so that we wrote a number of letters to the Portfolio Committee over last year asking for engagement so that we can, you know, move these issues forward and bring this report to your attention. And then eventually there was a decision taken to escalate our actions of civil disobedience in order to get the attention of the Portfolio Committee. Now, it's always very, very sad when citizens have to resort to protest in order to get their voices heard. It would be much preferable if we can have engagements like we are today in a cordial manner with decorum and, as Mr. Shloli correctly says, with facts and information at our disposal. So we are very happy that we are at this point, as you indicated. And as we indicated to the management committee of the Portfolio Committee last week, we are not so much interested in the past as we are in the future. It is what we do today and what we do in the future that is going to really be of importance. We are happy to let bygones be bygones and say that we misunderstood each other in the past. And that at least now we are talking to each other, and that is the important part. Mr. Shloli, as far as it goes with regards to mining companies, we can say that we deal with mining companies with respect. We write to them as would be proper. We request meetings, we request information, and we do have an ongoing engagement with them. We have a legal department that writes letters to mining companies and asks for proper engagement. So it's not as if we are just rocking up at the mining company in a protest and demanding unreasonable stuff. We are trying to be constructive in the way that we contribute towards the building of South Africa, because we believe it's time for all of us to really put our hands up and to contribute in a meaningful way. And so we are trying to do that, and we are very happy that the Portfolio Committee has acknowledged that and is meeting us in this process. So we cannot apologize for protesting ever. That is a constitutional right, and for marginalized people, it is often the last resort. At least now we have avenues to discuss, so it's certainly not the last resort for us at the moment. And so again, thank you very much for that opportunity. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm getting an indication that the Chair is back on the platform and the network has improved. Chair?
Okay, thank you, honorable members, Makua and Amoa. Thank you. Thank you, Whip, for standing in. No, the rules are simple. I'm sure members will understand. We vote only if the chairperson is not part of the meeting. At this stage, the chairperson is part of the meeting but was unable to participate in the meeting. And I'm sure we know, all of us, that these meetings are open to the public and we need to respect the public. And therefore, the technical challenges I had, most definitely I had to, in respect of the meeting itself, but also in respecting the public, to show some decency and not disrupt the same meeting that we convened and in the main called by the same chairperson. So now feel free, you didn't commit anything wrong. I can request any member, if I'm unable to participate or my participation in the meeting will be a problem. Two, Chris, when you work, I think the simple thing one remembers to say that maybe the meeting was made a little bit poorer with the challenge I had. I would have thought, Chris, in my absence, you will just say that there has been an engagement between the leadership of Makua and the leadership of the committee. And unfortunately, the whip at that time could not be present in the meeting due to some commitment he had. But in simple terms, we were able to find one another. We had to take them through the rules of parliament, including how committees of parliament operate, because we felt it was necessary to have that discussion so that when we meet, we don't start afresh, throw mud at each other. If we needed to do so, let's just dispense of that. And then in the meeting of today, like this one, we then deal with the gist so that we understand that our differences are not based on attitudes, but our differences will be based on facts. And there's nothing wrong to disagree with regards to that. And all the issues that had happened, like they are saying, we agreed that from now onwards, we must have a very courteous, if there is such an English word, way in which we relate to one another. Our doors will remain our doors open. Maybe just to put the genuine at ease, one of the things that we have said is that this committee is represented by different parties, and it is impossible that all of them can develop a particular attitude against one or any other entity. For an example, you have got 6 from the ANC, you will get 5 from the opposition parties, 2 from the DA, 1 from the EFF, and 1 alternate from the EFF, but there is one with one alternate who is consistent, apologies made. You have one which is from the IFP and one from the ATM and one alternate or 2 alternates, which is one from the AIC and one from the from the PAC. Of those, any member of parliament, any, if he receives any correspondence, is allowed to present that to the committee, and the committee will have to develop an attitude on that. But having said that, I think from the presentation, because at least I listened to almost 99% of the presentation made, I think for me, honorable members are correct. The presentation makes no sense. In fact, Makua, there's one thing that when good work is done, we must appreciate, is that you are giving us a scientific exercise that you wanted to bring to the attention. And in my view, this is what we have to tackle heads on. Criticism should not be an issue. In fact, they must make us much stronger and to deal with issues. I think some of the things we must agree that they might be a reflection of a general problem that even ourselves as members of parliament, we are faced with from time to time. And as members have said, unfortunately, when you make a presentation, the committee has to go back and deliberate on that presentation, having asked questions of clarity, and it will then come back and say, this is what we think might happen. But what I think for me, the committee will have to take into consideration is that your research talks to specific, not general, to specific areas or companies that you have conducted your work. And therefore, it makes it much more easier for the committee to make an accountability exercise. I'm not sure in what form it will take, but surely somebody must answer on those issues. And if it means you need responses, I'm sure the committee will decide that. If it requires that, you must come back again, defend your findings against those that you have made the findings on, including the department. It will decide, the committee at that point, whether to do such. But in the meantime, I think even without the committee, so that we don't create some unnecessary expectations. Unfortunately, committees of parliament, the manner and the nature of their operation is not about recognition of structures. I'm sorry to tell the truth, but that's the reality. The reason, for an example, you'll get labor business is simple, because in the social partners platform like NEDLAC, most of these entities are recognized as four. You've got the government, you've got business, you've got labor, you've got the community structure, where some of the labor unions you will find speaking to the portfolio committee, it is not them that are recognized. For an example, I can assure you now, when we go out for research and conduct oversight, we don't go and ask the unions to do presentations to us. We go and ask the companies to account, talk to workers. It is up to the unions then to organize themselves when you are there as unions that will be making presentations. But we talk to workers, because recognition is another matter. That is why, and you'll find that most of those unions in NEDLAC, to put it simple, they are represented by their own structures. But I would say for now, for the sake of alleviating your concerns, you are allowed, and my request to do exactly that designate somebody who would look at the proceedings and every activities of the portfolio committee, brief the leadership of Makua Amoa that there is this matter that we might have an interest on. And on the basis of that, you are entitled and allowed then to write back to the portfolio committee and say, for an example, if we were to go out now and do and conduct an oversight on a social and labor plan, there's nothing wrong to bring to the attention of this committee that, in fact, where you are directed, we don't think it is a correct or direct place to go. We are of the view that here is the issue, the areas that you need to attend to. And then we will take that into consideration. And if then you say, based on the fact that we know that the committee is intention is to do 1, 2, and 3, then we will be able to advise the committee that before it undertakes that, can it consider these areas? We are doing this because if we were to do a platform of recognition, the difficulty that we'll have, somebody will come and say, but how did you choose this one and leave these other ones? So the question of operations of the committee do not necessarily even need a structure. If somebody who might be a member or even an individual of Makua or Amoa writes to the portfolio committee and say, here is my take on these matters of what I'm bringing to your attention, the committee can't just say, no, you are an individual. It must then look at the matter raised. And based on the matter raised, it must then see whether this is a matter that it requires to be taken. So every correspondence that is sent, it gets the attention of the committee, then the committee will then develop an attitude. But as we have said, that we will be able to revert back to yourselves and then say, what do we think is the way forward? But some of the issues may not even have to wait for you to come back and hear what is happening. They may require us to tackle and deal with them immediately head on, and keep on if there's any other matter. Lastly, on this thing, you are free also to engage with our staff that is responsible, especially for research and development, so that they can keep us informed as a committee on new areas of development. So we won't let these things to go without attending to it thoroughly. Beside that, can I give then your presentation with regards to the two items, the mining charter court outcomes as well as illegal mining? You will choose which one you start with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. If I may just say before we start on that presentation, that I think it may be important for us to just clarify that there are two areas of representation that we are concerned about. The one is about speaking to the portfolio committee, and I think we've clarified that very clearly, that we will write to the portfolio committee from time to time, as we have been doing. And hopefully going forward, we would have a better relationship and better understanding between us so we can deal with the issues. But the second element of a representation that we are concerned about is at a legislative level with regards to how the industry is set up. You know, the core point of our presentation was that communities are excluded at very important points of the legislative process, of the regulatory process, of the governance process. And we think that a process of the amending the law or reassessing the law in light of those shortcomings is important, so that community voices are located within the discussions. As you correctly point out, NEDLAC is set up in a way that is supposed, at least in theory, to have those voices represented. And the point of our argument is, so the voices of community, labor, and business and government represented in a forum so that decisions can be taken that is equitable and fair and just and advances the nation as a whole. And in the same way, we're saying that within the mining sector, those four community interest sectors need to be represented. The one that is not represented there is community, and that is what the law needs to be adjusted towards. But I appreciate that the PC will deliberate on that and will come back to us on that at a later stage. So our presentation on the mining charter is a lot less, you know, there's a lot less going on. Because we've dealt with most of the issues. I'm just trying to find the presentation, if you'll just bear with me, please. There we go. Okay, found it. All right. So, with regards to the mining charter, Chair, we were asked specifically to share our comments and thoughts on the judgment handed down in September of last year, in which Makua was a party to that case. We joined the case after the minister had argued in court that all the parties that were necessary to deliberate on the mining charter were not present. And specifically, the minister indicated that community interests were not at the table. And so the minister then asked the court to enjoin those parties. We were then enjoined to the court case as interested and affected parties. And we made submissions on that. And we were deeply disappointed with the outcome, even though it wasn't completely unexpected. So where do we stand with regards to the mining charter? So we're saying that based on our presentation, if one looks past the box-ticking exercise of the Minerals Council and the numbers that they presented to the Portfolio Committee, and we look at the alternative view that we've presented today, then we can say that the mining sector remains largely untransformed. I mean, that seems to be a general case, and it's reflected in the inequalities that still exist in society, the high unemployment rates, and the ownership structures, of course. So I'm sorry that the chair dropped out, but he's back now. So the MPRDA, as it currently stands, has an objective to ensure that the holders of mining rights contribute towards the socioeconomic development of the areas in which they operate. We have hopefully shown to the committee that this is at best questionable, and at worst, it is been a exercise in subterfuge, in hiding the real truth. And that, you know, as a problem of regulatory issues, but it is a concern that the sector remains largely untransformed. The mining charter, we thought, in a situation where there was proper stakeholder engagement with communities, and where the mining charter is able to introduce binding implications and penalties, and with an open and transparent auditing process, would have been, and in our mind still remains, the most practical way to work towards a collective target for transformation. But obviously, as we know, that the judgment has removed that option from the range of tools that we have at our disposal. Despite the Minerals Council again arguing that there's nothing to change within the MPRDA and that the MPRDA has adequate measures to deal with this, we reject that completely. We reject it for the reasons that we've presented previously and shown that development in mining-affected communities is just not happening, and it needs a specific legislative intervention. So we're saying that the current legislative accountability measures, where they exist, are vague. They do not provide targets, and they do not provide reporting standards. So we don't know who's doing what, when they're doing it, or how they're doing it. It's just a vague thing out there in the legislative ether. The existing legislative mechanisms have no adequate penalties. So they do not impose penalties. They do not provide the correct incentives or the correct payoffs for mining companies to actually engage in development. It is very clear from our engagements with the Minerals Council and with mining companies in general that they will only do as much as the law demands them to do. They've made this very, very clear. So where a law is unclear, where it's vague, where it's, you know, it's not affecting their bottom line, they will continue to ignore it. They will continue to pay lip service to it, and they will continue to use it as a tick box exercise. So it's very clear that mining companies, despite their claims to sainthood, are often nefarious players in the sector. And we can, again, we point to countless examples of where this is true. So there's no transparency in the current setup with mining licenses, where the minister is not compelled to reveal the compliance reports, is not compelled to have an open standard upon which mining companies can be held to account. And that is not helpful for the sector, and it really it works against transformation. You cannot have transformation in a dark corner. Transformation must be done in the light. That's an absolute requirement. We know that the mines and the state, being a continuation of the state that existed in the colonial and apartheid times, even though it is a democratic state, have a historical and ethical and legal obligation to ensure the social and economic welfare of all South Africans And mines carry a specific obligation to the people who are directly impacted by their mining operations. As the MPRDA correctly says in its objectives, it's that the holders of mining rights have an obligation to contribute towards the socioeconomic development of the areas in which they operate, because they have a direct impact on communities. They pollute the water, they pollute the air, they remove our heritage and our culture, and so there is a price to be paid there. So we're saying essentially that it is urgent and absolutely necessary for this portfolio committee to start the process of engaging in legislative reform, to bring into line the elements that we lost through the judgment. We need to get those elements into law in order to hold mining companies to account. We do, however, support the call by Mancosa for a transformation council that includes community, labor, industry, and the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, so that all parties can meet quarterly, at least quarterly, to discuss transformation in a structured and consistent way, and so that hopefully they can lead towards a legislative proposal that would be broadly acceptable to all the parties, but specifically to redress the shortcomings of the current legislation with regards to transformation and development of communities. We do reject the claim by Mancosa that the problem that the mining charter judgment has uncovered is merely one of a lack of standardized reporting. Instead, our research shows that there is a fundamental lack of focus on the developmental objectives and the place of communities within that process. So if the law is not mandating companies to and requiring companies to engage with communities in a more consistent and concerned way, then they will continue to ignore the developmental objectives and imperatives that that comes with a mining license. And we say this can only be remedied if the MPRDA is more explicit in its intentions to ensure that transformation, and if there are severe that there are severe consequences for non-compliance, together with greater transparency and greater rights afforded to communities to engage and hold mining companies to account. So in essence, Chair, that is our submission on the mining charter. So that's why we weren't too worried about the previous time that we took, in that this was relatively short, but I'm sure that the committee might have some questions around this still. Thank you, Chair.
No. Do them both, Chris.
Okay. I can do them both. Yes. Okay. Then, as regards to artisanal mining, I'm going to hand over to Pops Letoka in a little while, but let me just frame our contribution in this way. That as far back as 2016, Makua had called and hosted a conference, which we believe was the very first conference in South Africa to exclusively discuss the issue of artisanal miners. Because it was very clear to us from our work in communities that this question of artisanal miners was a challenge. Because they were being criminalized, you know, black bodies being criminalized is not new in South Africa, but it is problematic. And so we raised this issue together with the fact that we had been approached by miners in Kimberley, artisanal miners in Kimberley, and we had started to work with them where we mobilized thousands of artisanal miners to go to the DMRE and to demand that they be legalized. As many of you know, eventually those miners were granted a permit to mine. They're still mining today. And it has gone some way into at least addressing that immediate crisis that was emerging in Kimberley at the time. So here's an example of a area that needs to be legislated, which wasn't dealt with adequately in the MPRDA, and which we engaged the DMRE as far back as 2016 on the need to amend the legislation to deal with this question. As the timeline shows, that the DMRE failed to deal with it in an inappropriately urgent manner. Instead, in 2017, we made a submission to the Minerals and Petroleum Board with regards to the need to regulate the artisanal mining sector. And then we heard nothing further up until we took note that the DMRE started a process in 2018 to do comparative research projects in other jurisdictions on with regards to how they dealt with the ASM sector. We ourselves, with Wits University and Action Aid South Africa, we undertook a scoping exercise of the artisanal mining sector. That information is available to the portfolio committee. It's on our website, and we're happy to share that. It was, which in our opinion, and we haven't seen anything else yet in the sector, the most extensive survey of artisanal mining, which showed how the economy was being developed through this artisanal mining process, how these miners at the local level were generating income, how that income was spreading into the community, adding value, and in essence, doing what the MPRDA set out to do, which is to distribute the wealth of the mineral resources in a way that the MPRDA is not able to do. The MPRDA is very much focused on large-scale mining operations. It has an element of small-scale operations, small-scale mining. But there again, we're talking about, in terms of artisanal mining, those are big projects which artisanal miners are not able to access. But artisanal mining does offer us that opportunity, and that research shows it very clearly how artisanal mining impacts the extent of it, where they're located, how they're located, what the size of the sector is, and so forth. So we've done that research. It's there. That research led to a process of engagement with artisanal miners, and eventually Makua, together with Action Aid and others, we worked with miners to form the Association of Artisanal Miners, the National Association of Artisanal Miners. Paps Letoka, who is a member of Makua, is also the chairperson of the National Association of Artisanal Miners. So he will speak to that in a minute. And then by 2020, the DMR started to invite us to make comments on their draft policy. And by 2021, they published the draft policy. And 2022, we are now sitting with what can only be termed a bit of a crisis. So here's a process where we alerted the DMRE in 2016 to the need to adjust the law so that we can deal with this challenge. And by 2022, we are no clearer to dealing with it. So we hope that the MPRDA is not going to go through a similar crisis where the opportunity to amend things with foresight is not taken so that we can avoid the crisis that is obviously coming at us at the end of this tunnel. So we say that there are four key areas of that drive this problem of artisanal mining or informal miners, or as some like to call it, illegal mining, because there are illegal mining operations happening. We don't deny that. But we have high unemployment. At the same time, we have over 6,000 abandoned mines and unused mines that are just sitting there under care and maintenance. We have high levels of inequality and low levels of regulation. So those four factors, we believe, come together in a way that is brewing this growing storm of illegal mining. We say that the solution lies in utilizing these problems, these challenges, and bringing them together to use ASM to reduce unemployment, rehabilitate abandoned mines at the same time, and make unused mines active again. In this way, we distribute wealth to a broad base of people, not to an elite base, to a broad base of people. It gives people something tangible to do. It gives them purpose. And when somebody has purpose and is working productively, they become, or they have the potential to become, productive citizens. So we're saying that's the way for us to go. We believe that the draft mining mining policy has some good things in it, but as we've indicated to the DMRE before, there are a number of problems still that remains. So, having said all that, I'm going to hand over to Pops to deal with this in more detail. But before I do that, let us say I will leave this particular slide to the end where we can wrap the conversation up. So, Comrade Pups, would you like to come in at this point and just speak to your practical experience in terms of how you've experienced working at the coalface of artisanal mining?
Thank you very much, Comrade Chris. My name is Pups Sean Letoku. I'm from the National Association of Artisanal Miners. It's an organization of men and women from mining communities of South Africa who are practicing a subsistence form of work through self-regulation using rudimental tools to extract minerals to put bread on the table for themselves and their families. As Chris has already mentioned that in 2019, we established this association for the voice of artisanal miners to advocate for the plight of men and women who are practicing artisanal mining in South Africa. So yes, in response to our request to the DMRE to decriminalize the sector and legalize and also have the policy that will regulate the sector. The DMRE responded, I think it was on the high stages of level one in 2020. They started with the development of artisanal scale mining policy. So the challenge that we are, I will highlight the challenges that or this one of the things that some of the clause that we made a submission on, and we found that at the final policy, some of the concerns that were incorporated on the draft before are missing. So our challenge is also with regards to the, our challenge on the ground is with regards to the implementation of the formalization of the artisanal scale mining operations. Since there is no structure in place that is formed to implement. So there's no implementation structure in place until to date. So the problem that we are having is that the policy is not being amended into law. It shot the final stages to the parliament and also the attention of the president to sign the policy into law. So since we have alluded that we were part of the policy developments, part of the policy development stages. So what we are experiencing on the ground is that artisanal miners on the ground are trying to align themselves with the final policy that was issued and published on March the 31st, I think. Artisanal scale operations on the ground, they have took efforts to formalize themselves. So the problem is that they are doing that process in silos. The DMRE is just not coming on board, and also the Mineral Council as artisanal miners on the ground. They are met with the resistance from the large-scale mining companies. For example, one of our branches in Klerksdorp, who are going by the name of Kosh Artisanal Miners, they have registered a cooperative as the final policy recommends that a group of artisanal miners, permits should be given to a group of artisanal miners who have registered cooperatives. So artisanal miners on the ground are having a problem that of implementing the process, because they are the one who are practicing this activity, and the rest of it is felt by them. So they find themselves being more proactive than the government and the Mineral Council itself when it comes to the implementation of the policy, as it recommends that all the stakeholders must work together to implement. So, of course, artisanal miners are having experience of resistance from Harmony Gold, because where they are operating, it's also Harmony Gold is also operating. So they are having a problem where on the dams that they are working on, Harmony Gold is not coming forth to the table, and also we are having a problem that the regional DMR is on the ground. They are not in sync of what the national DMRE is doing with regards to artisanal small-scale mining policy. So the branches on the ground, they are having a challenge that whenever they are going to their regional offices, the regional offices they don't have any directive. They don't know on how they can go on, because of there is no implementation structure in place to help artisanal miners on the ground. So they are met with more human rights violations. They are still experiencing police brutality in all of our branches that are taking efforts to formalize. They are working in silos. There's no DMRE that supports them. There's no also large-scale mine companies that support them. So they are still met with resistance, and they are being harassed by the police. As also we have also realized that also the SAPS members are not aware of the efforts that the government has embarked on with regards to addressing the challenges of artisanal mining. So those branches that has the desire to formalize and to see a consistent and transparent policy in place that will manage and facilitate their operations, they are having a problem of resistance and from other government departments that are not in sync with the DMRE's plan on formalizing and decriminalization of artisanal mining. So all that burden to give awareness to all this stakeholder department, it is left with National Association itself to make sure that they are giving a policy awareness to this lower government department stakeholders. So also the issue that we are having on the ground is also during the policy development, the stigmatization also issue was left out. It was never addressed on the policy on how the government is going to deal with the issue of stigmatization, because currently also what we have found out was that many people still regard artisanal mining and informal illegal mining, as they cannot differentiate. So there is a definition concept that also we are struggling with it on the ground, and also the issue of how to first come first serve, because people who are actually practicing this artisanal small scale mining are not that privileged. So we know that the clause of first come first serve, it will work against the objective of creating employment for these distressed mining communities. And so that is also the issue that we are having a problem with, because we know that people who are having the muscle to arrive first at the DMR offices and get the permits are those who are already rich. And also the issue of hectares was of a concern to National Association of Artisanal Miners, and also the issue of permits to be reserved to only South African nationals is also giving us the problem on the ground, since on the ground we know that artisanal miners are not only South African nationals. And for the fact that large-scale mining has been using other nationalities from outside our country, and there was never a problem with regards to that. So why it should be an issue when it comes to artisanal scale mining? So we see it as something that is going to create a problem in future if it is left out without not being addressed properly. We'll pause there for now and probably wait for the questions if there are questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Pops. Che, if I can then just wrap this up very briefly then, to say that in our view, artisanal miners have never been recognized within the current mining regulations. The MPRDA, as it currently stands, excludes artisanal miners. And one of the concerns that we have is that there has been a broad effort to criminalize those who are engaged in artisanal mining activities without really understanding the drivers of it and how artisanal mining is in the long term able to contribute to the South African economy and dealing with the question of unemployment and wealth distribution. We are of the view that discrimination against poor and marginalized communities. Sorry about that. We are of the view that the discrimination against poor and marginalized communities is an inherent feature in the MPRDA regulations. And we say that this is part of the problem, is that the MPRDA currently stands geared towards large-scale miners, which is a legacy of our past, and fails to deal with the marginalized and poor communities which it's supposed to serve. So we are of the view that if we do not address this discrimination, the subtle discrimination within the MPRDA, which excludes communities to a larger extent, we feel that many of the class discriminations inherent in the MPRDA will continue to be advanced in the draft regulations proposed by the DMRE. In that, when it talks about reserving ASM permits for locals, there's no similar regulation that is contemplated in terms of large-scale miners. Large-scale miners are able to come in and they're able to extract the wealth of our country, and there's no reservation with regards to only locals In fact, part of the problem of transformation sits in about how do we increase South African, Black South African representation in the ownership structures. So we think that it's unfair, it's discriminatory, and it shows a class bias in the way that the MPRDA is structured towards large-scale mining. So people and groups like PUPS, who are local South Africans, who are working and trying to legitimately put food on the table. And, you know, if there are miners who have work permits and are here legally, they should not be discriminated against in that way. And the separation between legality and nationality should be separated. So it's not a question of just if you are a foreign national that you shouldn't be able to access it, but it should be a question of have you got your papers in order and that kind of thing. So we think that there needs to be a greater emphasis to understand the local conditions and what is driving artisanal mining. There is no way we are going to police our way out of this problem. Policing is important, and yes, the efforts by the minister and the SAPs to form specialized units must be welcomed because of the deep levels of criminality that has been allowed to emerge underground, really. From underground, they've merged to the top. And when they came to the top and started to affect people directly in a public way, then it only became a problem. But this is not something that artisanal miners are new to. The problem sits in the fact that the sector was not regulated. Where the sector is not regulated, there is a vacuum. And where there is a vacuum, power actors will emerge to fill that vacuum. And this is what is happening in the sector. The sector has not been regulated. There's not been a plan to work alongside law-abiding citizens like PUPS and the Kosh cooperative, so that they can also act as part of the regulatory process. So where they are legitimate miners, you can rest assured that they will work in harmony with police to ensure that their interests are protected and that the rule of law is put in place. But where we are going to blanket a term and say that every artisanal miner is a criminal and therefore must be imprisoned, that presents a problem. So we urge the portfolio committee to insist that with the DMRE, that this process must move forward. But it must move forward in a way that is going to build, because you cannot, apartheid has taught us that you cannot police your way out of a crisis. We have to find ways in which we utilize our existing strength, the people that we have, the willingness to work within the system, the need to put food on the table, the need to distribute the wealth. Bring all of those elements together and we can make a sector that works for the country and really produces a productive outcome. So that's essentially our approach to the question. And we hope that it will find favor amongst the committee. And all that remains now, Chair, is to say that we thank the committee for your time and for being open to listening to our views. And like you said, you know, we don't have to agree on everything, but hopefully a discussion can pursue an ongoing engagement. So in other words, we hope that this is not the last of it, that over a period of time, we will be able to work with the portfolio committee to come to outcomes that are going to be in the interest of all of the country, and in our case, specifically in the interest of affected communities. So thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Makua. Thank you, Amoa. Thank you, Chris, and your team, Mr. Mbangula. I think this is what is good for South Africans. From time to time, we must be able to find one another. I don't want, I'll make my comments later and my area of worries. First, let me check from the honorable members. Are there any questions of clarity, both from the mining charter or comments and the issue of illegal mining? I prefer to use that word, Chris. I'll tell you why when I make my own comment or questions. Is there any hand going one, going two, going three? Okay, there is none. First, let me appreciate your inputs. Let me start first on the issue of the mining charter. The first thing that I think we have to check whether we find one another, and I think you have highlighted in your input on the mining charter. The first question for me, and it has been standing from what the Minerals Council had been saying, that in the absence or in the absence of an approved legally mining charter, what becomes the status of the mining charter and the compliance requirements? And I'm raising this thing because one of the things we've raised with the Minerals Council was that it seems from their side, every time they make an argument, is that there's too much regulation. And let's agree, all of us will differ from time to time. Those who want to maximize profit, when you try to manage that, they will then tell you are doing too much. And those who also want to cut the maximization of profit will feel that you are not going at a pace that. So I don't think we have to. My only concern is that I would have thought you will assist us on how do we tackle currently the uncertainty on the mining charter as to whether it is enforceable or not. That's the first issue. The second thing is that I hope I had it, but I didn't hear it to be saying how I understand. English is a very complex thing because you can say something, but somebody won't hear you. What is your attitude, Desmakoa Amoa, with regards to the audit timelines? For an example, part of the problem in the mining charter has been that compliance with the requirement of the charter, which was at some point over a 10-year period, is that the only time where you've got an outcome of compliance or an outcome will be on the last year. There are no intervals where you say at this pace, for instance, if the department comes and present its annual targets and annual performance, but also its term of targets, then annually it will have to put something within that annual period. It will have quarterly reports that we can be able to measure and say, at this pace you are going, one, in this financial year you won't be able to meet your annual targets. You will dismally fail in terms of your annual performance. But lastly, in terms of your expenditure patterns, you won't be able to achieve what you have placed for yourself to achieve. And when we look at that over your five-year period, which is your term, you won't be able to meet those targets that you have set for yourself over the term. What is the attitude of Makoa Amoa with regards to the lack of term measurements on the performance and the fact that that mining charter currently leaves an uncertainty on its status of enforceability? The third area that I think I want you to say open, because I'm raising this in conjunction with the first part, and I'm not intending to revoke what you were saying or the past of misunderstanding. The nature of the performance of a portfolio committee is obviously subject. The first thing, like I said, even when we had our meeting, that don't you think at some point, let me put this proper question, don't you think at some point, regardless who takes the first initiative, we need to look at the system that we adopted post-1994. I'm raising this thing because you are talking to a leave
this committee, but generally, you are talking to a parliament that has got the least budget compared to the least budget of the department, but it is expected to provide and conduct oversight. Don't you think we adopted, put it simple, don't you think that we adopted a executive-friendly system as far as governance is concerned? And how do we attend to that? So that the issues that you are raising, the third point, the fourth point, which is linked to this, in terms of this, don't you think all of us have a duty, including particularly yourselves as key stakeholders, I regard, and I said, we don't see you as enemies, but as strategic partners that can guide from time to time, depending how we relate, because that's a different story. But don't you think that there is a problem that where the actual accountability has to take place? For instance, when the committee was conducting the gas amendment bill, one of the things we realized was that in most of the areas where we're going, there would not have been, I'm not saying there were no interaction with yourselves and the stakeholders. On the point that we're raising on legislation, we may not at least talk about prior drafting by the department, the executive authority. But let's talk about our view has been, let me put it from a committee point of view, that before the committee of parliament goes, there must at least have been within the executive authority a comprehensive consultative process on what it is proposing. So that the points that you are talking about to say, yes, you want to amend this or you want to put this thing that is new, our view is this. I think at times where there is the conflict starts is that only when the committee of parliament takes what now has been presented. Unfortunately, that's what the legislative process of parliament says. It says the committee can decide whether it wants to do public consultations or not. Now, in most of these situations, is that when you arrive there, we find that that is for the first time. And there's nothing in law that says the same way parliament committees are supposed to conduct public hearings, it is supposed to be the case with the executive. I'm saying part of the things that might arise now out of our experience of the gas amendment bill is that there has to be a concerted effort. How it is done procedurally, it's something else that even the executive must conduct similar exercises as the committee does. But fifthly, as we make this proposal, how can we manage? Because some of the things we're talking about are more technical. For an example, we may like to say, I may give you an example where we were the misunderstanding. We may like to say we are going to KZN. When you go to KZN, your wish is to go to Hammersdale. I'm making an example, or is to go to any part of a Thekwini municipality, whether Mzinyathi, which is in the north. But you are dependent on that municipality, but also you are dependent to those who claim, who say are the stakeholders, to say this is where we think you can, because the issue of mobilization of people and the organization of venues primarily becomes a responsibility of the municipalities. Don't you think that we have, to some degree, unable all of us to manage the issue of cooperative governance and accountability as far as, because ordinarily you come to explain a legislation. The actual people are your ward councillors and others that are supposed to be responsible for this exercise. We're saying we want you to look at a broad input that can assist so that even ourselves, when we go to the broader or other structures, forums of parliament that deal with these things, we can raise, for instance, we understand what you say, but it is not clear as an alternative how within the procedures of parliament we can go there to say, for an example,
it should, I'm making an example, shouldn't it be so and so with high authority who write and say, this committee is coming, this is what is expected from you, part of cooperative arrangement. I'm raising this not that you must substitute what you are supposed to do, but I think from a public point of view, when some of these things come in, it might be, they may even make more sense that they are coming from civil society. So that is one part as far as the mining charter is concerned. And I take the points with regards to the other issues. I think we can take. Now, let me be straightforward on the illegal mining. Don't we think that there's a difference? One, there are different types of illegal mining, call it illegal or informal mining. I don't think for me, policing up the police, by the way, I might say now, you are more advantageous even compared to the committee because the committee deals mainly with legislative issues. And that is why when the Minerals Council says the mining charter is a policy, not a legislation, one of the things was, okay, if you say so. So in order for it for you to comply, you must make it a legislation. So if that's what they're asking for, I think the committee must take that request that until you make it a legislation, we're not going to comply with it. And that's the issue. Then we can start to deal with the modalities. But I'm saying, don't we think that, and I agree 100% with artisanal mining, shouldn't we separate artisanal mining from illegal mining? But also, shouldn't we be careful to make illegal mining all being criminal? But also, shouldn't we be careful to make, not to make illegal mining all not to be criminal? I'm raising this thing because, for an example, if we take the example of Northern Cape, where there was a conversion to artisanal mining, I think it's one good living example. But in other areas, we must concede. This is why I'm worried about your four pillars. Your four pillars might be disrecognizing one of the biggest challenges that we are having, organized crime or criminal syndicates, so that we don't make illegal mining as if it is not criminal, but at times even give something that may be seen, and I'm saying this is extreme caution with the absence of a better word. If you go to people now to Krugersdorp and say out of even that incident that had taken place and say it is only as a result of the four pillars, I doubt they will ever be one to hear that. Let's accept there is a reality that even some of our neighboring countries, which is why from a point of view of the discussion, is that should we treat the issue of illegal mining in particular, because I can compare artisanal mining to the Zamazamas. Shouldn't we deal with the issues? Even if we say it's illegal, the illegality is at different levels of what is actually the reality of the situation. Because if we were to say it's about poverty, it's about this, some of the communities, when they complain, they are worse off under some of these conditions. And they may not even want to listen when you say, no, it is not, it is something that is as their own creation. Shouldn't we separate some of these things and deal with them separately? Let me make an example. One, if you look at chrome, the activities, one might argue and say, you need to find a better fast-track system of making sure that people, even at a community level, are able to access licenses and everything so that they operate formally. But there are incidences of your derelict and ownerless mines that remain disused, that even on your projections that you gave here, it will be absurd to give and say artisanal mining can take place. Because in some of the areas where these illegal mining activities are taking place, they are a threat to residential spaces. One, two, they are a threat generally and a risk in society, because in some of these cases, those mining activities are even include the mining of pillars. And we all know that in order for you, when you do mining, one of the things you must leave there for the balance, for to remain balanced, is to leave some of the pillars. You can't mine the pillars. And the incident that currently we are still sitting with it, trying to find a solution to, which is the Lily Mine incident. Amongst the accusations that are being made was that the company that was responsible for mining there, for that to collapse is because they were now mining the pillars. So there are some risks that we may have to avoid. So I want us to look at those things and say, the question of illegality, it can't be a one-size-fits-all. If I'm wrong, that's okay, but I want your connection. That is one thing that we have identified. The second thing is that in some of the problems that you are having, is that are we not dealing with the low-hanging fruits, not dealing with the tertiary problem? For an example, it's not easy to mine diamonds and carry diamonds and everything. It's very strict. Amongst the things that are a debate now, shouldn't we go to a very strict regulation of a gold as a commodity? Because that's where the actual violent part of illegal mining takes place. The third one, because even if you were to arrest hundreds of them, as long as you are not dealing with the high syndicates, which are the ones that might happen in one way or the other to be carrying formal licenses, or if there is such a thing, or who might be legal, but the products they are carrying might be finding a way to be refined so that it becomes legal, not in an illegal way. Shouldn't we start to work on that? There is a talk, for an example, that at an international level, gold must be categorized in that similar fashion, including from a UN and so forth. The last point on this issue of illegal mining is the fact that when you look at it from the violent side of it, one of the things is the contradictions in legislation. Like you say from your MPRDA, let's take the Krugersdorp case, or let's take even many of the other mines, that active mining stops as soon as the BRPs, the business rescue practitioners, come in. For a longer period, there's no activity. And in the absence of that activity, that's when attraction of illegal activities and territorial wars now, because it becomes more like a gangster platform. Part of the things that are in consideration is how do we harmonize and reduce the period with regards to the issue of licensing and enforce the principle of use it or lose it, and the ownership, regardless of business rescue practitioner intervention, have to be guided by giving more due recognition on the primary legislation responsible for licensing. I'm just throwing those things so that we may find that there are certain areas. For instance, on artisanal mining, I think you may have your take. There's generally a view in the policy that the limitation of artisanal mining is that it doesn't talk about underground mining. It talks more on open cast, not necessarily on underground. I think some of those issues are things that we can say, let's find a mechanism, and if it means from a committee point of view, we invite the department to make it this presentation with regards to, I think that's what we can do, to the draft policy on artisanal and small scale mining. I think that one may not be a big issue to do, and then come back, especially with the inputs that you have given us as shortcomings. I think that will empower this committee. But I think let's accept, or shouldn't we talk about the bigger problems? Let me give it to you, Makua, if there is any response or take you want to make on these things. I was just raising the issue that in some areas, these communities believe that their own freedom or independence or way of life, of living, is taken away, not just even by undocumented, let's try and say, But all that they will tell you that it is not them and they don't want anything to do with what is taking place in that area. And therefore, perception might develop that the same victims we make as if they stand to benefit out of that exercise, or they are responsible for the criminal activities that are taking there. Let me hear your take, Makua Moa, Chris.
I thank you, Chair. That's quite extensive. Thank you very much. Let me try and just deal systematically with some of the issues, and then I'm sure that if there are any things that I miss, our delegation will be able to just cover that. So I guess the first question that you asked was regards to the status of the charter. Where does it stand? Look, our view, Chairperson, is that before the judgment, the mining charter was, its effectiveness as a tool to measure transformation from our perspective, from a community development perspective, was not useful in the way that it was structured, in its lack of consultation, and the fact that it didn't have any clear targets in the sense of community development or penalties and so on. So we've dealt with that extensively, where we say that the charter, even before it went to court, had its shortcomings. But at the same time, it was probably going to be the most effective way for us to advance transformation, as you correctly pointed out. If it is only a policy, then we will need to bring that policy into life through legislative engagements or legislative changes. So that's the challenge for the portfolio committee, is that the mining charter has no legal standing. It is not something that we as communities can rely on. So we can't take a mining company to court and say, here's the mining charter, it's a legal obligation, they're supposed to deliver on X, Y, or Z, they haven't done it, and therefore we seek redress. We can't do that with the current mining charter. So for all intents and purposes, as the court, if we are to accept the court's judgment, which we must, then the mining charter is merely a policy document, and I guess the Minerals Council is correct in that status. So we think it has no more legal standing than policy would have. And as we know, policy is limited because it doesn't have legislative elements to it. So the need to amend the legislation to include transformative elements is critical and urgent. We are aware of the fact that the Minerals Council and most businesses generally, in line with the free market thinking, believe that businesses should have no regulations, that it should be a free for all. We take as much as we can, and we don't want to pay anybody for it, and we want to accumulate all the wealth and so on. We believe that that lack of regulation is precisely part of the problem with regards to how wealth is accumulated in the sector. Because the legislation doesn't regulate wealth distribution in an effective way, and which is what the mining charter, I guess, tries to deal with, even though we don't agree that wealth should be distributed at an elite level, but it should be distributed at a broad-based level. So we think that the mining charter tried to regulate wealth distribution and fair distribution of the nation's resources, but it had its limitations. And now, after the judgment, it is even less of an effective mechanism for us to do that. So it is urgent, more than urgent, that we need to address that legislative lacuna, where now there is nothing that we can go to court on to hold mining companies to account. So it's a free-for-all, and our social audits show this, and it will only increase now that the mining charter has lost its legal status. You know, prior to that, there was a general acceptance that it is law, and that we have to abide by it. And now there's just nothing, absolutely nothing that holds people to account. The only thing that we do have is the mining licenses, which obligates that a company must have a social and labor plan. But again, it's unclear what it means if there is no social labor plan, or if the company doesn't deliver on the social labor plan. So in terms of getting a mining license, all the company needs to do is to say, we promise to deliver you all of the things that we saw them promise. We're going to deliver these beautiful amounts of money and investments. And at the end of the day, we're just not going to do it. And you know what? There's nothing you can do because the law is not clear about what you can do. We've given you the paper, is the next thing they're going to argue. And here's the paper. You said we must produce a social and labor plan. You never said we must deliver it. So there we go. So for us, it's very clear that is an urgent need to rectify that. And so whether the Minerals Council like it or not, the fact of the matter is that they are the products of colonialism and apartheid. They owe a debt of obligation to this nation, to this people, to mining-affected communities. And the Portfolio Committee, as a democratic parliament, has an obligation to ensure that that happens, according to our constitution. So for us, there is no uncertainty around the mining charter anymore. The court has dispensed with that. It is very clear that the mining charter has no standing and that the portfolio committee needs to just do something about it. In terms of the audit timelines, look, we understand and appreciate that projects by its very nature needs time, and that the first part of a project is often the planning phase. And so you will not see much happen in the first year, most likely. You might not even see something happen in the second year, but after the planning has been done, and if you've done your planning very well, the project should be up within the third year, you know. So a five-year timeline is workable, and it's not always helpful to measure it in a micro way. But the fact of the matter is there has to be penalties. There has to be a level of compliance that is expected, because management is one thing, right? So managing it is one thing, but to expect the portfolio committee to manage it on a monthly, yearly basis, I think is asking a bit much of the portfolio committee, given, as you correctly pointed out, Chair, that the portfolio committee has been combined. It's got two very big portfolios that it deals with, both minerals and energy, and it has a small budget, limited staff and limited time. So for us to expect the portfolio committee to do that kind of monitoring is just not feasible. But what we do say...
No, sorry, Chris, I don't want just... No, I don't do that. All that I was saying is that don't you think that we should build in, so that when we do the mining charter through the legislation, yes, we should build in timelines, because the, yes, problem with the current arrangement is that you don't have timelines. You only realize on the last end of the charter, as I look, that there is no compliance. And the fight now becomes whether there is compliance or not. But if you, yes, have a regular timeline, you will measure whether these people will meet. That's the context.
Now, I do appreciate that, Chair. I'm going to get to that now and say that, so yes, timelines are important, but what is more important for us, Chair, is that there are consequences for non-delivery. So the point that I've made to the Minerals Council before is that the Minerals Council was bragging just recently to the Portfolio Committee about its $1 trillion turnover or RAN turnover. And when we look at the kind of projects that the Minerals Council or mining companies generally take on, which generates 1 trillion rands worth of turnover, then those are massive projects, huge, complicated, deeply intense projects. Now, when it comes to community development, where they take 0.15% of that, then suddenly this very effective wealth generating industry is not able to manage R1 billion worth of projects. Now that seems to me to be a pointer towards risk and reward, right? Mining companies are going to put the energies and make sure that things happen if there's enough reward in it, or if there's enough risk in it that their non-compliance will hurt their bottom line. The fact of the matter is that development does not bother them. It is a flea on a massive elephant. It is of no consequence. It is a mosquito in the ear. They feel nothing for it. So what we are saying is, if we want to prioritize development, the penalties and the consequences need to match our desire to see development in the sector. So yes, it is about time management, but more importantly, it's about consequences, about the risk and reward. So, you know, for us, that would be the important element in it. So part of the timeline question, which the regulations around social and labor plans, which the department recently published a couple of years ago, is helpful in the sense that it does require regular feedback to communities and structures on a quarterly basis. Now, that kind of feedback and systems is important, it's good, it's helpful. But what we need to do is the MPRDA needs to strengthen the role that communities can play within those feedback sessions and the requirements upon mining companies about the transparency and the nature of how they report back. So we need to tighten that up, and then communities can play a role in helping to manage timelines, in helping to hold mining companies to account. Because the fact of the matter is that the DMRE does not have the wherewithal to do all of the regulations on their own. So it would be wise, in our opinion, to rope in communities, to give them additional legislative support that will ensure that mining companies are going to be held to account. So in other words, where an organization is able to engage in this quarterly report backs, and an organization like Makua can undertake a social and labor social audit, you know, let's use those mechanisms to hold the mining companies to account. But it needs legislative backup, because at the moment, when we do engage with mining companies, they still ignore us because there are no penalties. So that's part of the challenge which we need to talk about in more detail, and which I'm sure we can't do right now. In terms of the comprehensive consultative process, we agree 100% that there has to be a lot more consultation before it gets to the portfolio committee, and before the portfolio committee is put in a position where you were with the gas amendment bill, where the DMRE failed to consult with us effectively, and in one instance where the regulations on resettlements and a couple of other things was done. You know, we tried to engage the DMRE, and they just ignored our inputs. They just kind of continued to go ahead despite our objections, despite our concerns. And that leads to confrontation and conflict. So what we are saying and what we have proposed to the portfolio committee is, let's legislate the process in which there has to be consultative process before it gets to the legislative stage, and that it must include all the relevant stakeholders, including communities, in the process, so that when it comes to you, it is not about controversy, it's not about confrontation, you know, it's about process and advancing. So we think that that must be built into the legislative process, so that we can ensure that doesn't become a time of confrontation, but rather a time of reconciliation and cohesion. And so, yes, the executive, in our mind, does carry too much power. Part of what we are asking the committee to deal with is to devolve some of that power, to say to the executive that, yes, you have the power to give licenses at the final resort and all of that good stuff. But there has to be processes, checks and balances. Any good system will have a check and a balances. The voices of the affected and interested parties must be incorporated. It must be there. And, you know, we have to have that process. So we say build that into the legislative process so that when it comes to that public participation period, that it is a period of cohesion, a period of advancing and not of confrontation, as I said. Coming to the artisanal mining issues, absolutely we must separate illegal mining and syndicates and those organized criminal syndicates from the ordinary people like Pops Letoka, who are basically just trying to put food on the table. There must be a separation, absolutely. Our members, including the members of NAM, are completely opposed to criminal syndicates. We do not propose or suggest or support any activity that seeks to usurp the role of the state. We don't support activities that threaten communities in the way that these organized crime syndicates do. We work with a lot of communities that are faced with these criminal syndicates, and we have suggested in our proposals to the DMRE, and when the time is right and you are hearing those submissions, we can take you through them. But essentially what we're saying is, again, part of the solution to the syndicates is to involve communities in a more structured and coherent way. So we're saying that where cooperatives are formed and where, for example, they are mining close to communities, that those cooperatives must be accountable to the communities in the same way that a large-scale mining company is going to be. They must be accountable to the communities for things like pollution, things like, the way that their members operate within the community, and the things that kind of revolve around that. So there must be a process wherein if a site is allocated to a cooperative, that they are accountable to the community and that the community must be seen to be broadly benefiting from that. In that way, if we involve the communities in that kind of oversight, that kind of participation, the space for illegal syndicates to dominate the vacuum shrinks. We make it smaller and smaller until we are able to deal with the problem in a holistic way. And so we say part of the solution to dealing with the illegal mining is to involve communities in a way. And we've detailed our recommendations in that regard in our submissions to the DMRE, and we're happy to share that with the committee when the time is right or upon your request. So we say, yes, let's separate illegal mining. Let's promote proper legal mining through proper cooperatives in which the value and the benefits of those processes accrue to the community as a whole. And yes, we have indicated to the DMRE with regards to underground mining. We have made it clear to them that we believe that the policy must deal with underground mining. If you cannot just ignore this problem, it's not going to go away just because you haven't legislated for it. In fact, it's going to increase. It's going to exponentially grow. So we say there has to be a way to do this. And what we are saying here, Chair, is that there are two things. The DMRE and large-scale mines have not made a plan for what to do after mining. So in many of the towns that we find the illegal mining syndicates, it's in towns in which mining is on the decline in a big way. But the large-scale miners and the DMRE have not made a plan to rehabilitate and close off the mines. That's part of the problem. So we say that if in the policy and in the way that we unfold this plan, that communities are involved in rehabilitating and closing of the mines in the way that I described previously, then we have the opportunity to, again, isolate the syndicates and to make the space smaller for them. And over time, we hopefully will get rid of it. But there has to be a way to use the existing structures to support communities so that the communities can take control of their own lives and their own situations and isolate these syndicates. And yes, we must target the high-level dealers, and that certainly is where we believe the police should put their focus, not on the small people, because our research has also shown that the people at the bottom end of the value chain are not making enormous amounts of money. The miners are going home with maybe 3,000 to 5,000 rand a month. The syndicates are the ones who are creaming the profits. So the ordinary persons that the police end up arresting are not the problem, but they become the problem if the police are not there. So there has to be an urgent move to formalize miners in a way that there can be a separation between artisanal miners who are within the system and illegal syndicates who are operating outside of the system. And it has to happen concurrently. So we cannot just go in and arrest people, shoot people indiscriminately. We have to say, let's do all of that, but at the same time, let's formalize these miners. So we know that we're dealing here with potential allies and not with potential enemies. And then we can narrow the spaces as we go along. So there has to be a concerted, coherent, holistic approach. Yes. So, yeah. So we believe that as the assessment of legislation proceeds, because you know it's been 20 years since the law was put in place, the jurisprudence has evolved, the political terrain has evolved, the consciousness of mining affected communities has evolved, and the whole space is just different. We're dealing with different challenges than we did 20 years ago, and so it's by time that we do look at the legislation, and the more urgent we do it, the better, because the crisis is only growing in the absence of concerted leadership from our political leaders. So I hope that helps to answer some of your questions, Chair. I don't know if any of my colleagues want to touch on any of the issues I might have missed. No. So Chair, I don't know if that provides some kind of response to you that is helpful.
No, in the absence of an addition. No, that's fine, Chris. We are here. We are engaging. I'm sure I always say that the fact that we are members of parliament does not give us natural wisdom on everything. We are here also to get some more on what we think. So I don't think even when members were not asking, they are looking at how do we process some of those issues. But before then, I go to closure and then give the way forward. Are there any last words from you? It can be you, it could be Mr. Mbangula, either of the two of you as leadership of Makoa Moa.
Yeah,
you choose between yourselves.
Yes, I'll ask Mr. Mbangula to close off for us, Chair. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you a lot, Comrade Chair, and the Portfolio Committee as a whole, really, for using this day to give us a platform to communicate with you. We really highly appreciate that. And to our comrade in Makua for, again, joining this meeting, we very highly appreciate that. We believe, again, that is if this kind of platform will be open for us, a lot of things will be dealt with in a appropriate way, and will open up other opportunities for those communities who are not aware of these platforms. And I believe that is if we can work with this way, mining as a big contributor in our community, in our economy, will obviously benefit or everyone that is hosting it. We like to hope and believe that we will have another time to talk again and set things up. Thank you a lot, Chairperson.
Thank you, Makoa Moa. Honorable members, we are almost at the end of our meeting for today. The committee will revert back to yourselves. Most definitely, can I request again to yourselves, Chris, please don't wait until it's late. We are currently faced with these problems. Send us the submissions you've made with regards to the policy on artisanal mining. We will distribute it to every member of the committee so that it informs them going forward. We don't have to discuss and agree as a committee, but it's necessary information to empower them as members of the committee to also get some views. The second one, the issue that you have talked about when it comes to illegal mining, in particular the site that is of concern to date, which is the organized syndicate or the organized crime or gangs or theft wars and so forth, and that you have given to the department, I think it will be welcome. We take note of the issues that we have raised, and we will be able to tackle those issues. Some of them, as I've said, they may be beyond the scope of the committee, but they are within the scope of the legislature, which is parliament, in our case, the National Assembly. I think there are areas that I would say we share a common view on, that I think it encourages that we must take them with the authority, with our own principles. If it means there is a need to review the rules and other things, we will make those, at least I would say, I hope I'm correct. It encourages the committee to look at reviewing some of the rules of parliament so that they favor effective public participation, and also strengthens the effectiveness of committees of parliament in the performance of their tasks. At this time, I'm sure we have dealt with many of the issues, and thank you very much with such a, I think it has been a very constructive engagement, and we hope, as you have said, that we'll continue to engage. Like I said, Chris, it's free, I'm always available. But it's better when you talk, you know that you talk to leadership. Feel free to contact me on any other matter. For now, especially that we don't have any better system or official system. In some of these issues, especially when we are going to deal with legislation, I know now in relation to the MPRDA, we've got the upstream Petroleum Resources Development Bill that is being proposed by the department. I will say at times don't wait until the formal processes of parliament, because as we have said in the last time, sometimes all these issues are subject to the rules of parliament that are not flexible. There's nothing wrong with that. We want to bring just two lines. We want to bring to your attention that when the bill or as the bill is going to be presented to yourself, please note that we have got the following. It may not be in terms of the substantive, it can be the procedural matters. Please be made aware that as people who represent mining communities, who have not seen public consultations, with the affected communities. One, two, these are the things that we think have not been taken care of. It assists the committee then when it then invites the department to present on its first briefing, to brief the committee on what it is proposed, whether it's a new legislation, whether it's a new amendment, to then take those into cognizance. As it takes them into cognizance, it may utilize what you would have given it. For an example, to check, have you consulted? What were the processes? Which areas you went to? You see, so that we know that, because I'll be honest with you, even if they speak to Makua Amoa, it doesn't mean they would have consulted the communities, because Parliament in the main talks about public consultation must go to the people, not to structure, not necessarily. It's not wrong to engage structures, but it must go to the people. So it will help us then to get some of those things so that we preempt some of the exercises. Rather than, for an example, our experience, most of us, on the Tax Amendment Bill, when you go to people, you would not have asked certain questions to the department because it is presented anew to you. You only, when the public hearings, you go to the people, start to get much more opened up minds that, oh, okay, there's this limit, there's this issue. Now, it means when we come for the second time with the department to say, what is your take? Unfortunately, we would not have corrected them to say, even before we go and consult with the public, can you go and sort out 1, 2, and 3, and then you come, they give you an opportunity to rectify 1, 2, and 3. So my request is that even if we don't necessarily stick to our formal procedure, when you have picked up that there is this particular legislation or proposal that might come to the committee, please give us hints ahead. We're not saying we'll agree with you, but at least you are alerting us so that even by the time we go after engaging the department, by the time we conduct public hearing, we also know now that there are these factors that must be taken into consideration. But on that note, thank you very much for this fruitful engagement. Thank you very much, honorable members. Can I then declare the meeting adjourned? The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.
Not yet, Chair.
What is it now?
Minutes.
Ah.
14, Chair.
Do you still have the energy for? Let me check first, my one. Remember, some members are going to join the House today. 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, we are. Can we go to the minutes? 6. Yeah, I can flag them.
Chair?
Yes, my Honourable Malinga.
Are we doing this in front of our guests?
No, minutes, every meeting of the committee is open to the public. But they are free to leave if they want to leave. No one can be dismissed. Except if there's someone who recommends or who requests an in-camera meeting committee in advance and reasons thereof. Okay. Honorable members, these are the minutes of the 31st of May. We go. Leave item 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The only thing, Ari and Ayanda, can you go up? Oh, okay. No, that's fine. Okay. No. I thought it's about the adoption. Okay. Any more of the minutes?
I move, Chair.
Any seconder? Honorable Marans, are you seconding? I saw that your mic was. Thank you very much. Any matters arising, honorable members? Going 1, 2, 3. Okay, nothing. Next set of minutes. One, continue, Ari. One, that's two, three, four. Well, you go up on four. Anyway, it's still a matter that we are with. Okay. Okay, fine. Any move of the minutes?
I move, Chair.
Oh, Dumela and that.
Dumela, Chairperson.
Okay. Any second that Honorable Bulkula?
Chair, I want to second, but I also want to check on the attendance and apologies there. I think as much as I did not start the meeting, I think it's a meeting that I joined late. I don't know what I'm speaking under correction, but I do know that I started the meeting late in June.
It means when the meeting started, you were not present and you did not tender an apology. The only thing you must sort it out, I think, I under an Ari. Like where you put something there, ne? I think for the sake of the minutes, you must put something like you put on the alternate, you put a star, either you put a hashtag or whatever, for so that we know and it be cleared that joined late or left early. Something to that effect. Because as you are correct, somewhere then your name reflects, but you are absent in the meeting. It might happen that you make and you support the decisions, but you are written as if you are absent. I'm sure we'll correct that so that we know that that person, even if his or her name reflects on the minutes as a contributor in whatever form, then it must reflect that it would be, the reason is having you present and absent. It's exactly what you say would have joined the meeting late. Okay, is there any matters arising? Going one, two, three, none. Next set of minutes. Oh, what a break. One, two, three, four. Okay. Any mover of the minutes?
I move, Chair.
Any seconder?
I do second, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Volmarans and Honorable Malinga. Any matters arising? None. Let's go to the next set of minutes. Go one, two, three,
five, six, seven. Any more votes? There is minutes.
Yes, Chair. I move.
Thank you, Honorable Lorema. Any seconder?
I second, Chair.
Thank you very much. And as arises, going one, two, three. Is there any other minutes, Arif, even for today's meeting?
Okay. No, Chair.
In the absence, can I then declare the meeting adjourned? Is there, or I understand the correspondence, honorable members. We will talk about that when we have got a proper feedback next week with regards to the oversight visit. On that note, honorable members, the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you very much. Till next time.
Thank you, Chair.